Okay, I want to look just a little more before we start talking about Yashar Mamash, about, you know, the main topic of this shiur tonight. I want to just look a little more about, you know, the time of, period of time we're talking about. We're in, you know, early 1600s now. And as we went over in the last week, in terms of where Jews are living, this is the period of time where the Jewish community in Amsterdam gets founded. It's also the period of time when the Jews have been trying to leave Portugal, Spain, the Portuguese Jews who were forcibly converted by the Inquisition, and then in 1497. Have been trying since around 1580 to try to leave Spain, Portugal. And initially it's not hard at all. They were able to go to the Low Countries. That means Holland and Belgium. Was not able to get a good copy of the Scheldt Estuary to explain that to you more specifically, how things really originally worked. That's more technical details. It's not so important, really, technically. So we have a phenomenon. I want to go try to stay across in the order that I work through things to make it basically make sense. I hope, you know, that's one of the challenges of history, for the records. You know, the world at large is divided into a vast majority of people who are not that interested in history. Many of those people, as mentioned before, suspect that history is potentially fatal.
Those who know from history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah. Okay. Wait a second. Yeah, but most people are falling asleep. That's what the history teacher says: is you're falling asleep.
Doomed from learning this stuff. You know.
Okay.
I think it's those who learn history are doomed to teach it.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Anyway. Why are people so challenged by history? And I'll tell you the reason why they're challenged. It's not mathematical. In other words, there's a large body of fact, and there's not always, you know, when you learn it in high school, they attempt to make it like simple and straightforward, and this, that, the next. Like, I think I mentioned here this year, but maybe I didn't. You know, if you learned about the First World War period, we learned about that recently. They'll tell you there's the triple alliance and the triple entente. There's no such thing as the triple entente. That didn't exist at all. I mentioned that. They'll tell you it did not exist. Right? You can go back and tell your high school teacher. If they know history, they'll know that. But a lot of people who teach history don't know history, so they won't know that. But if they know history, you say, yeah, there's no such thing. It's true. But we just do it to simplify things. So the point is there's like history sort of like there's like a lot of chaos. When it appears to be chaos, there is meaning coming from the chaos. But there is a pattern of meaning, but it's complicated, it's not so simple. Because we're interacting with Bechira, we're interacting with human free will. And human free will is, according to the Ramban, the most fundamental of all chukim, of all laws in this world, are human free will. That's the most central, immutable chuk law of interaction from Hashem in the world is Bechira. That's what the Ramban says in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. Well, he doesn't exactly say it that way, but I'll show it to you later. And I'm sure if you tell that to Rabbi David, he'll say, oh yeah, it's Ramban in the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim. It's not exactly how he says it, but you'll see that that's like, I said something else like this, like when, like, you know, yeah, Gemara says something, so I hold it means something else. I mean, it means what it says, but there's an obvious logical conclusion. So I still have to say that to Rabbi David. He says, yes, well, where's Gemara in the Torah? I said, okay, no, come on, that's where I got it from. But Gemara doesn't really say that. It's just, yeah. So this is the same type of thing. Say this to Rabbi David, I'll tell you, yeah, it's Mufurj Rabbah. Okay. So, this is really a fascinating point. Now, I hold the most, at least for me, the most, you know, moving part of the history is Shkaha, is providence, when you see the exactness of how things work out. Because they were very exact. Very exact. Now we have two things going on here. We have one thing, and they're not really related. Their mom is not related. We have the Spanish absorb, conquer, whatever, it's complicated, let's not get into it, Portugal, and that causes all these Muranos to decide to leave. That's one thing going on. We'll come back to them in a little while. But there's something else going on also. And we can diverge as a Jewish history class. We can diverge now to talk about the Protestant Reformation. Yeah, very good. We can talk about the Protestant Reformation. This is very important. That is one of the most important historical, you know, in the last 500 years. There's no question that's one of the most important historical happenings that ever had to happen. It's you know, again, this is a watershed. This is like an event that completely changed the world.
It's definitely probably the most.
Say again?
It's probably the most important.
It's a hard, that's a good and difficult question to answer. It's like, I remember, you know, 11 years ago, I quote the turn of the century, or so, at the turn of the century, there was a lot of debate out in the world. What was the most important event, idea, event, etc. of the 20th century? It was a very big debate. Some people said Marx. Some people said Hitler. I think a Time officially ended up nominating Einstein. That's what I recall, right? Remember that? That's what I remember. That's what I recall. Okay. Is it possible? When my wife took a history class in college in 88, that was like the very tail end when people still thought Marxism was viable. Now, I mean, we look back at it now and we laugh at it. But intellectuals were very into Marxism. Very into it. I was once in a math camp at Emory University. Yeah. And there were a lot of Marxists there. A lot of those Marxists were Jewish. But there were a lot of Marxists there. So, I mean, today we laugh at it. But back in the days it was considered a real moving idea. Okay, so today, when we look at things today, and I just, you know, I got an email from a former Talmud, talking about these issues, and we tend to view Catholics as more religious and traditional. And Protestants is less religious and less traditional. Of course, there's an exception called Southern Baptists, but if you live in the South, most people are not aware of the, you know, depth, extent, etc. of the Southern Baptists. But in the world at large, we view Catholics as being traditional, and Protestants as being less religious and less traditional. The historical fact is that's not really that accurate. Is in the biggest historical picture, that's not really that yet. That's not really that accurate. I mean, this guy seemed to think that Italians are close to the papacy; they should be more religious. And historically, it was really the exact opposite. People in Italy knew exactly what was going on in the papacy. It was sort of like, you know, family politics, and they didn't care about it that much, and they weren't necessarily that religious. I mean, you understand that the Renaissance and Enlightenment all started in Italy. So, okay. Now, the person who founded the Protestant Revolution's name was Martin Luther. I hope we are aware of that. Okay. Martin Luther, as you may be aware. Oh, there you go. I'm happy someone knows that. He was highly anti-Semitic. I mean, not like, yeah.
Wasn't like originally he wasn't anti-Semitic, and then when he tried to recruit the Jews and...
Okay, it's more complicated than that. Yeah, yes and no. In other words, you're sort of right that initially he accused the Catholic Church of bad tactics, and that's why the Jews couldn't get the Jews to convert. So then he tried to soften his tactics and didn't get anywhere with that either, because it wasn't just an issue of tactics. And we'll go on. Let's go on a little. Let's go on a little, and you'll get the picture. But then it's true. It's sort of true. It's not really true, because obviously if after a short attempt he went from not being so anti-Semitic to being rabidly anti-Semitic, he obviously was quite anti-Semitic the entire time. I mean, I don't remember where I saw this recently, but I saw this. I know where I saw it actually. But I'm not bored. As someone pointed out, and the point has a lot of validity, that in more modern times, in other words, 19th century Germany, when historians at large will say grouping of peoples were more pro, not as anti-Semitic. And as a certain, Holocaust historian will point out, and I hold the point has a lot of validity, that's not really true. They were nicer to a certain extent, but there was still a lot of anti-Semitism latent and lying in what they were saying. In other words, the Jews really, okay, sort of true right now, they're terrible, but we could convert them. They weren't really that religious. They weren't talking about, you know, about converting to Christianity, but we could reform them and change them, et cetera, make them okay. But it's lying in that type of statement, really anti-Semitism, when you say that there's something about the basic Jewish character which you don't like. So anyway, getting back to our point. Yeah, Martin Luther, as you know, is very anti-Semitic. The real key question is, what was his big revolution? Now, Sam said it's one of the biggest events in the last... No, Josh said it's one of the biggest events in the last 1,000 years or 2,000 years, and you might be right. It's a hard question, you know, ex post facto to say something strong about, but it's possible. What was his big revolution? What was his big revolution? What was the core of his revolution?
Core purpose?
No. What drove Martin Luther's intellectual revolution? Yeah.
Modification of the church. He was sick of all the bad things going on. For example, the sale of office.
Okay, that's true. Okay, modification of the church and getting rid of the bad things like the famous indulgences, or the infamous indulgences. Okay, that's sort of true, but that's not the intellectual dynamite which set off the Protestant Revolution.
Maybe he didn't believe man could be. Maybe he didn't believe enough.
In what?
In a sword.
And what's saying?
The Pope was the Pope.
He did not believe in the Pope. Yeah. Yes, that's true. He did not believe in the infallibility of the Pope. That is true. That's true. But it's not the core of Martin Luther's thought is a piece of absolutely intellectual dynamite, and that is examine the sources. That is what he said. That is where he started from. He said the Catholic Church has set up the Christian religion with these, you know, ideas involved. Okay, but I don't want to get, this is a Jewish history class, I'm not going to go through all the ideas right now. But what did Martin Luther say? Let's examine the sources. Let's examine the sources. And there were two primary sources, which are, as I call it, as theirs is Tanakh, that's one of the primary sources, and the False Testament, the other primary source. Those are two primary sources. And one of the keys, and this is I'm not sure why I'm saying it, but I'm going to say it anyway. One of the key critical issues was the idea of intermediaries. Catholics believe in intermediaries. The priests they hold are kilo between whoever, whatever. You know, when a Christian says God, they're thinking Yashka. Yashka and God by Christians is the same exact thing. Rabbi Feldman from Atlanta. No, yes. Tales on a shul? No, okay. Anyway, so as he says, he was asked many times, Jews believe in God? So they say, yeah. Do you believe in Yashka? No. How's that possible? That was like standard. He had it so many times, you know, he didn't even bother keeping track. And so his answer was very Jewish. He said to him, well, what part does Muhammad play in the Christian religion? So they would say, none. So that's exactly
with Yashka the Jews.
He's, you know, he got the Jewish religion. No. Anyway, but get sir, there's a very core belief, a very important part of all Catholic thought, and that was absolutely rejected by Martin Luther. Absolutely rejected. Now, part of the key issue was examine the sources. And part of examining the sources is, does the False Testament work with Tanakh? That was a very key critical issue. Key critical issue. Now, initially, history takes a long time for things to happen. A very long time for things to happen. There's a fellow, you have anyone heard of Erasmus here?
Yeah.
Erasmus? Yeah. Do you know, where's Erasmus from? Erasmus, no? Anybody? Okay. Erasmus was from Holland. He himself, he's considered the intellectual father. He's really the one who came up with the idea of examining the sources. He managed more or less to maintain a balance, even though after a certain point in time, it was open war between Luther and the Pope, open war, an No going back. The winter didn't stop. No going back. Erasmus managed to, like, he managed to, he was just somewhat older, but he withdrew and had nothing to do with it. But people, historians hold that he's like the intellectual father. That's what historians hold. Why am I telling you about Erasmus? Because Erasmus, even though in one sense, you know, very deeply, he ingrained the idea in the world that in order to be educated, you need to know three languages. Three languages?
Latin.
English?
Nope.
Greek. Latin, Greek, and?
Aramaic.
Nope. Hebrew. Those are the three languages. If you're an educated person, you must know three languages. Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And to a certain extent, he was a, you know, he was examined the sources, and that, he's like the real beginning of the revolution. But this is just going to try to show you that how long it takes real ideas to change. In terms of Parshat, in terms of understanding Tanakh, he absolutely refused to entertain any idea at all that the traditional Christian approach, which had been incorporated into Catholic thought, could be wrong. And that Chazal, and that the way the Jews had looked at it, he refused, he would not, it was you know, like by him, the greatest of all sins would have been to learn up Tanakh the way that the Rabbanim, the way that the Chazal did. That by him would have been the greatest of sins. Okay. That's the early 1500s. Facts are good. Luther let out this piece of intellectual dynamite, and even though all the initial Protestants and reformers all more or less went with Erasmus in terms of how they're going to look at Tanakh, and also how they're going to look at Shas, Midrashim, etc., etc. That was the initial reaction in the early 1500s. The Catholics eventually, as we mentioned last week, had their reaction, which again took about 50 years, but that's when their reaction took about 50 years, and their reaction. And the Catholic reaction was, we're going to be traditional. We're going to defend the traditional approach, and they made, you know, they came up with their sort of answers, etc., to defend the traditional approach, but we're going to stick with the tradition. Because the Protestants, you know, again, they took this major step of forget tradition, forget Christian tradition. We're just going to try to examine sources. They didn't have, once you do that, you're out, you're floating. And eventually, it took time. Again, it just took at least 100 years to start happening in a real way. They started coming around and saying, you know what? Maybe there's some validity to the Jewish approach to learning Tanakh. It took around 100 years to happen. So you have, starting in around 1600, a rise of real, quotes, they're called historically philo-Semitics. People, you know, intellectuals, thinkers, writers, who said, okay, I mean, there are different levels. Many, if not most of them, were still motivated as, if we'll understand Tanakh properly the way the Jews do, we're going to be able to convert them to Christianity. I mean, don't think that was not motivating a lot of them. The Rambam says in Geras Taimon, that the most primary fundamental motivating, you know, concept, idea behind every person who has power is how to undermine Yiddishkeit. So it's not. I'm not really surprised by, you know, they're philo-Semitic, but no, because that's, you know, the most obvious. Just a second. It's a very, you know, it's sort of like Davidoff. Okay? Davidoff is the other side of this. There's no one in the world. There's no one in the world who is unopinionated about Davidoff. No one. I've never met anyone. You tell them 5 sentences about David, they're going to be highly opinionated. They don't even know anything yet. I don't call them arguments. If someone's not sure which Sifrei Tanakh David wrote and is discussed in, and they try to start arguing with you about how to understand David Amalf, I don't really call that an argument. Because they don't know, they have no facts. They don't know which Sifrei Tanakh to look at. They certainly don't know any of the Midrashim, what Chazal, what has been said. They don't know anything. So they're ready to argue. So Jewish people are the same thing. David's a microcosm of Jewish people. People are very hyper-opinionated about Jewish people. I thought you were asking a question. Okay.
But I was going to ask some information. These guys learned up like Rishon and Matanach?
That's a good question. I was not able to. I mean, I'm working in a secondary source, and a number of secondary sources. Not sure. Some yes, some no. In other words, there's a well-known one who didn't write his name down, so I don't remember it right now, who translated the entirety of the Mishnah with the Rambam and Bartanura's Parish in the Latin. Because he held that there's no way you can understand the False Testament if you don't understand how they were thinking. And how were they thinking? They were thinking like the Mishnah. But we have Tanakh already, so that you know. But in order to complete the picture of what their mindset was, you have to see the Mishnah. And no one doubts the Mishnah. No one, the biggest cynic doesn't doubt the Mishnah is written at that time. So that's important. We have to complete the picture. And translate it. How well he understood it, I don't know. I'm 100% sure that the person whose book I'm reading doesn't understand at all to figure out if this guy understood it or not. Because the person whose book I'm reading, the two people's books I'm reading, neither one of them has competency. I'm not even sure if they have competency in Chumash Rashi, and certainly not in Mishnah. And if you don't have competency in something, you can't evaluate. You don't have to be, you know, the biggest expert, but you have to have competency in your topic, and a topic to see if so-and-so who claims to have competency really has competency. You know, vast bakias, vast wide knowledge, means someone has a very strong memory. Doesn't necessarily mean they understood it better. Again, like, yeah, I'll get off the topic. History, you're always off the topic. Okay. Isaac Newton, who's a little later, is not going to come into this class. As you guys know, that he left thousands of pages of writings about Kabbalah.
What?
Thousands. Isaac Newton. Okay. I'm so curious to know how, if he really understood it or didn't understand it. I'm very curious. I don't have that much time. I don't have enough time. It's in Cambridge. I don't have the time to put into it. And I only know one, there's only one person I know who would even bother doing such a thing. I have a friend. He taught here last year a little bit. Rabbi Goldman, Rabbi Sholem Goldman. I have no idea. The only person I know who would actually do such a thing, and knows enough to say something, and knows enough, and it wouldn't come out and sheet to one way or the other, would do real analysis. Is Rabbi Sholem Goldman. I don't know. I have no idea.
How did he get his hands on a Zohar?
You could. No, the Zohar was whatever. Not. Okay. The Zohar was printed by Christians in the mid 1500s. It was translated by 1600 into Latin. Okay. Again, I told you, Erasmus said, and that's like the background. You know, if the legal language of America could have been Hebrew, that wouldn't have been the spoken language, it would have been the legal language. What? That's all. Yeah, you've heard that, have you?
Why?
You never heard that? Okay,
okay.
Funny guy.
Oh, so cool. Why?
I don't know what would happen. No, it would have been like this. The legal language in Germany was Latin. Okay? Holy Roman Empire, that was the Roman part, was the legal language was Latin. And when the founding fathers said the legal language of the United States should be Hebrew, they didn't mean they were going to speak Hebrew in the street. They meant if you're going to be able, they're going to write the contracts in Hebrew the similar way that anything legal in Germany until 1806 was written in Latin.
They didn't know Hebrew.
Erasmus had already established anyone who's educated knows three languages.
Oh, they actually knew Hebrew.
There you go. So not every one of them, but a lot of people knew Hebrew. Because if you're an educated person, you know Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. Okay. Yeah, okay. Okay, now. Again, but the facts are, is even if there was a certain paradoxical and two-faced look, approach over here, that on one hand they had more positive feelings about Chazal and traditional ways to look at Tanakh and Jewish traditional ways to look at Tanakh. On the other hand, again, there are many of not Muslim wanted to convert us. The facts are this laid a philosophical basis for toleration which did not exist earlier. Especially in Protestant countries, and most especially in Holland. Okay. Now, getting back to the Muranos. The Muranos are a very different case. The Muranos, this is, again, this is like such a piece, I was like I was pretty moved by this, you know, thought and discovery which happened in the last 48 hours or so. The Muranos are coming, again, unrelated. The Muranos leaving Spain, Portugal, has nothing to do with Reformation. That has to do with political event, which we talked about a little bit. But they're hitting Holland, and they're establishing themselves in Holland 1595 at the exact same time that all the Tefillah Semitics are just coming into the cultural form. The exact time that the Tefillah Semitics are coming into the place where, again, you know, maybe Jews aren't so terrible, the Jewish ideas of Tanakh aren't so terrible, that's the exact time that the Muranos hit Holland, 1595. Now, the Muranos are complicated. And I told this to Rabbi David, he agreed with me, they're the beginning of the modern world. They're the very beginning of it. What are the Muranos? Again, we don't know. It's historically impossible to prove if there was any real level of Hebrew literacy in 1530. In 1520, 1530. There probably was some, because again, they were forcibly converted in 1497. And it means anyone who was, let's say, up to 10, 12 years old in 1497 probably was literate in Hebrew. And their parents certainly were. But by the time we're speaking in, which is around 1600, it's, if not almost nobody, basically they were all absolutely illiterate in Hebrew. And they have been forcibly absorbed into a Catholic, not Jewish environment for over 100 years, which is three or four generations, depending on how you want to look at it. So now they were persecuted also politically, at least in Portugal initially. They're coming out. They were moving to Holland and other places. But Holland was the. But Amsterdam is that's like the prime city of the Muranos. And some of them. It's hard to know numbers. You have to understand that in the pre-modern world, numbers and, you know, real numerical quantification ranges between difficult to impossible. And, you know, again, everyone's very opinionated about Jews and Judaism. So no one really knows. Another majority, minority, no one really. I don't think it is well quantified at all. It does seem that a large amount, clearly a substantial amount, were interested in becoming or reverting to Judaism, because it did establish Jewish communities in, you know, Amsterdam, Hamburg, etc., etc., etc. And because they were still sort of in touch with the people who actually had left Spain in 1492, and there had been Muranos who had been able to leave Spain and Portugal earlier, when they went to get Rabbanim, when they had to bring rabbis in, they brought in rabbis, Sephardish and Rabbanim, from Morocco, Italy, you know, even some, maybe possibly in certain cases as far as Constantinople. They were still sort of in touch. But we have a large body of Jews who have been cut off, not only cut off from traditional Jewish education, etc., that have been forcibly incorporated in the non-Jewish world. Now, education has always been a Jewish ideal. So even though they couldn't have Jewish education, Jews are always believe in education. It's like very deeply ingrained in Jews. So we have a large body of people. And I don't know the majority, but a large amount of them are very interested in being Jewish. Some of them are not so sure what they want to do. And there's a definite known minority. They're called crypto Jews. That's what they historically called crypto Jews, who they weren't quite Jewish and they weren't really Christian either. Now, one of the things that happened was once you were Jewish,
identifiably or like officially?
They're officially unofficial. Officially unofficial. It's officially unofficially. That's what it was. Now, the ones who left Spain earlier, Spain and Portugal earlier, and the ones who had completely reverted to Judaism. In other words, once they left, they went straight back and said, "Okay, now we don't have the Inquisition. We're going to be Jewish." They started writing in Portuguese and Latin books to convince their cousins. In many cases, literally their cousins and brethren, that I did it, you should do it too. Okay? Okay, that's the as I said, that's the beginning of the Tshuva movement in the real way in the modern world. This is where it begins. This is where it begins. That, and as a matter of fact, because they wrote these works defending Judaism in European languages, Portuguese, Spanish, and or Latin, they were educated, right? But they were really from Catholic countries, so they really know Latin. They wouldn't know Greek or Greek and Hebrew was from non. Greek and Hebrew were considered bad for Catholics, but yeah, everyone knew Latin. Their books got out to the world at large, and that's part of the Philo-Semitic movement, was because they had things written by people who, by some of the people who were very educated, others weren't quite as educated, but did have basic knowledge of what Chazal wanted, written in a language they could understand, not just in Hebrew slash Hebrew or Aramaic or Rabbinic Hebrew, in a way that if you're not initiated, you're not going to get much out of it. Okay. Okay, so now we're about, now with all that, we're ready to start Yashar. Now we have a historical picture ready, we can start Yashar. Yashar, very interesting person.
Here, let's see.
I only need to write one so we know his name. If you could, his name was, I mean, this is like a riddle here.
His name was Yosef Shlomo Yitamadiga. Yosef Shlomo Yitamadiga. And that gets you to a question. If his name was Yosef Shlomo Deladigo,
they thought the Dalad was British.
Why is he called Yash?
Okay. So I'm not going to answer that yet. I'm going to go on and tell you a little bit about this. No, that's not it. There's a much better, there's a real answer to it. And it's not a mistake. Let's go on. I'll tell you who he was. He's called Yashar of Kantia. He's known as, what's the
Yashar of Kandia. Does anyone have any idea where Kandia is?
Rocco?
What?
Rocco?
Kandia.
Kandia is in Crete. And ironically, Yashar was of Ashkenazi descent. Okay, as mentioned, Ashkenazim originate from Germany. But Jews were more or less thrown out of Germany between 1450 and 1550. Between 1450 and 1550, Jews were thrown out of Germany. Even there was some, even a little earlier, as early as 1400, the expulsion from Germany come. There were some Jews left in the Ecclesiastic States. A lot of the Jews went east to Poland, and that is the body of Ashkenazi Jewry today. But others didn't. Some went to Italy. And Yashar's family ended up in Crete. He studied in a university in I think Padua, which is northern Italy. I'll tell you what he studied: philosophy, math, astronomy, and medicine. He studied with the famous Galileo. That's right, he did. So now, why do you think he was called Yashar?
Yashar.
Yeah. What? No, not because he was straight. Okay?
It's because they thought the devil.
And after he finished all that, what did he do with his degree? Practice medicine.
Oh, Rofe.
Rofe, very good. Yosef Shlomo Rofe. That's why he's called Yashar. Okay. One of the books I read about these things has a chapter called Jews on the Move. It's a chapter called Jews on the Move. And Jews on the Move...
The biggest chapter?
No, it's one of the first chapters. And Yashar was really on the move. Again, he started out in Crete, Italy, Egypt, Constantinople, Romania, Poland, Lithuania, Germany, Prague. Those were his known... That's where we know he was. And it took a long time to get from one of these places to the other. So this is a person who, all over the place, he's what I call a true intellectual. And this is like, it's, you know, like, what's it, how do you define an intellectual? Okay, you don't know if you understand this. It's just like, you have to see more of life to understand this. Someone can be extremely smart, and they can get, you know, they could break, I'm working in my days, okay? They could easily break 1,400, 1,500 on their SATs. That does not mean they're intellectual. I have someone who's sort of related to me. He's a little, whatever, he's approximately my age, a drop older, whatever, not exactly important. Yale graduate from New York. Now, it's not easy for the records. I don't know, the Ivy League schools initiated a quota policy in order to limit the amount of Jews in their schools. It was initiated around a little over 100 years ago. I can't remember the guy, famous president of Harvard, can't remember his name right now, but if someone threw out the name, then I'd be able to say, yeah, that's the guy who did it. They were concerned there are too many Jews in the universities, so you can't, in America, you can't openly discriminate. That's against the law. I mean, even if it wouldn't, whatever. It's basically, it's not very non-American to do. So what did he do? He said, quotas. We have to have diversity. We don't want too many people from any one state, like
it's
New
still,
York.
It's still like that, though.
It definitely is. You're absolutely right. There's a quota guy. Like, I have a different friend who's also a Yale graduate who's from Hawaii. So I told him I'm extremely unimpressed. If I was from Hawaii, I'd be able to get in Yale without a problem also. It's not a problem. If you're from Hawaii, there's not that the quota, there's whatever. It's not that many people want to come, and you're not competing with all the smart Jews in New York. So this is a person. I know the person relatively well. And he must have done well on in high school and his SATs to get into Yale, because it's not possible. If not, it's just not possible. From New York, it's not possible. I mean, if he was, if he's from, I don't know, if he's from Montana, or from the state of Alabama, that wouldn't be so hard. But if you're from New York, it's not easy. But he's not intellectual. He doesn't really care. People, intellectual people who love and care about knowledge, when they hear a new idea or a new fact, oh, that's something else. Let me think about that. Let me look into that. That's an intellectual. So Yashar is a real intellectual, because he just loved to learn. It didn't matter what it was. Okay. Now, Yashar is a very complicated person. He's very exposed and complicated. I mean, just his life history shows you he was all over the place. He was literally all over the place. He met, talked to, was friendly with a lot of people straight across the spectrum, regardless of religion. You could see where he was. I mean, he started out in Crete, which is Greek Orthodox, Greek / Rite Greek, that's one type of Christian. Then he went to Italy. It's a different type. Then he managed, he spent time in Egypt and Constantinople, which are Muslims. Then he worked his way up and eventually hit some, other types of people. And he also was friendly with Jews across the spectrum, including Karaites. Including Karaites, people who reject the authenticity of the Jewish law. Now, we're not going to be able to finish all of Yashar today. It's too complicated. So we're going to... But I feel it's important to go through the basics. To show what I think specifically in this case. I don't have what I consider final conclusions. I would have to spend a long time on it to make final conclusions. And unless someone was paying me really well, I wouldn't spend that long on it. No, it's not. You're not talking about, one of the most central figures. He's an interesting figure. And I just spend a nice amount of time researching, working on Yashar. I hope maybe to find one of his svarim before next week to have something more substantial to say about him. But it just takes time to quantify everything. And the only way to do it the best way to do it is see what he wrote and what people who knew him said about him. Anyway. Okay. Very complicated, difficult person to understand. What I call the assumed approach in the world at large is that he's what they would call a proto-maskil. You understand what that means? In other words, maskilim were people who rejected Torah, rejected the authenticity of Torah for science.
How is it spelled?
Maskil. Maskil. Yeah, maskilim, yeah.
Not like...
Proto.
We say it that way, don't we?
Say again?
Not
yeah, no, okay, 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 okay. That's mamish not for him. Anyway, That's a difficult topic. Maybe I might be saying, I might touch on that a little Tuesday night. I may, that a lot of the Shabbat guys are nudging me to talk about the quotes, what they call the dating controversy. And I might talk about it Tuesday night, but I'm not yet sure. If I do, I'll probably touch on that, those issues also. Yeah. Okay, anyway, the academic world out there is definitely convinced, without a question, that he's a proto-Maskil. That means he really wasn't, you know, deepest in his heart, he wasn't religious. He was really a scientist, etc. That's what they think. It's a really, you know, it's a very sensitive topic. You know, in one sense, Keelan, we're talking about a person, and as you know, a very basic part of Amis Yisrael is that you don't want to say someone is a Russian, you don't want to say someone's a bad person. And to say someone didn't believe in Torah is like the ultimate bad you can say about it. So I'm very hesitant to call someone a non-believer unless I have to. And if you have to, you have to. I mean, if you do, you do. You know, certain people I'm not hesitant about at all. But Yashar, I'm very unclear about. I'm very unclear about. And I want to go through now. We're going to start out. I want to do one more step. I'm going to do one more step. We're only going to do one more step tonight. Okay. In a technical, scientific, Kilu scientific fashion. What do we need to, when we have a person like this, whoever it's going to be, how are we going to try to evaluate who he is, what he is? How are we going to try to evaluate that? And this applies to, and Yashar is the beginning of this issue. I mean, there are people who sort of think it applies to the Rambam, but I'm not sure that's not true at all. And I said sure on the Rambam here 3 years ago, and I hold this absolute whatever. Not now. Who I talked to about dinner, I can explain the Rambam as best as I can, but not now. What do we need to look at? So I hold this three basic bodies of fact that we have to examine. Three basic bodies of fact. First body of fact is what did he write? What did he write? Let's look what he wrote. Now the Rambam says in Igeres Tchias HaMeisim. No, sorry. In Igeres HaShmad. In Igeres HaShmad. Unbelievable. If you want to know. You want to know why you can be Madaik the Rambam. So the Rambam says, before a person speaks, they should think carefully before they say something. Because you're speaking and you're telling people something, you should think about it. Don't just get up and run your mouth. Says the Rambam, and before you speak. Before you write something for public consumption, the Rambam says, you should hazard over, you should go over it 1,000 times, if it would be possible. To make sure you've achieved absolute accuracy. So, you know, the Rambam, that's why, you don't know why we can knock the Rambam. The answer is, the Rambam was very aware of what he was writing was for the public. He was as careful as it was physically possible to be careful to write something as accurate as possible. And that's true about all the Rishonim. There's interesting, you know, what they call in Hebrew Makbilot, this interesting parallel statement of the Ramchal in his preface to Derech Hashem for the records. And he says something, not Mamshi, the exact same thing as Rambam, very similar to the Rambam. Okay, now, the Rambam was absolutely an intellectually honest person. Absolutely intellectually honest. And there's no, you know, the Rambam's shittas can be traced through all of his ksavim. I mean, the Hakdamas, Yad Chazaka, Marduk Vuchim, letters, private letters. We have a lot of private letters of the Rambam for the record. You may not be aware of it. Maybe next year I'll say a shir about, I think I'm going to say on the Rambam's Hakdamat HaChelek and a couple of other interesting things. Hakdamat HaChelek, Geres Tchias HaMeisim, and probably one or two of his very not so well known letters, which are very fascinating, which are like conceptually related. But anyway, the facts are that in the Rambam's times, the scope of conflict between Torah and outside of the Torah world was much more limited. Even in Yashar's times, it was not as it was not as broad. I mean, it was, part of it's Kabbalah, and I'm just dangling that. We're going to get to that next week, the Kabbalah issues. Part of it's Kabbalah. Kabbalah quotes what people will historically term Kabbalah versus rationalism. That, you know, historical trend. That is one of the issues. So that is a scope of issue. The Rambam's time, the Kabbalah was basically hidden. It wasn't completely, it was there, but it was, I spoke about this last year, but it was basically hidden. So it's hard to know. In other words, in Yashar's sense, he did write things for the public forum, he wrote things, but there's certain truth to the fact that, unlike in the Rambam's times, when Kabbalah was in the background, there's no question the Rambam maintains absolute intellectual straightness from the beginning till the end and everything we have about him. And once you get to, there's certain topics which even if you have personal doubts about, you shouldn't publicly speak about. And in Yashar's time, that's sort of true. So that leaves, in other words, he wrote things about the Kabbalah, for the Kabbalah, and next week we're going to talk about a little bit more details about what's going on with that, you know, the tumult about that, and people raise a point. Because that's, again, we have what we call body of facts is, what did he write? He wrote a couple of things. There's some other things he wrote which are very important, and I hope they'll look at one of them. I'm not sure if it's been reprinted recently, but it might have been. And if it is, I hope I'll be able to take a look at it. He wrote a lot of things. You need to look at that in order to ascertain fact. Secondly, private letters and or diary. That would be very important. There is at least one specific private letter of Yashar's, which we'll talk about next week. But we'll talk about the problems with that letter also. If we would have his diary, then a diary is really the best. You cannot get a better historical piece of information than someone's diary. And that's why I say, if you want to know the great era of historical research, the greatest era of historical research is Victorian Edwardian England. In other words, the Western world from 1850 to 1940. And the reason why is, not only is everything governmentally documented, everyone wrote extensive letters to each other, kept a diary, and wrote their wives and or mistresses' letters also. So, you know, like, there's points in time where we could see the guy said this, but he told this person that, he told that, and you have so much information, it's almost overwhelming. But you can get a real solid picture of what's going on. So, if we would have Yasha's diary, which we don't, then we really know what's going on. But we don't have it, so we don't know. We have a letter or two, which is of whatever. We'll talk about that next week. Third, and this is also very, I hold this is possibly the most important, is Talmidim. Did he teach people? What did his Talmidim think? Where did his Talmidim lie? I mean, in Yashar's case, it's very important, because Yashar was not stuck in one place. And in the old world, and this is a common problem, I think we may get there at the end of the year, do you have a person who would change communities, and he would pretend to be something he wasn't? And, you know, later Sabbateans, as they call them. He would walk into a new place and he'd pretend that he was a regular, normal person, and he really had some ideas under his belt that he was planning on selling once he got acceptance, once he got social public acceptance. Yashar was all over the place. The last 25 years of his life, we don't know exactly how long he was in Prague. We know he's buried in Prague, and we know he was there a significant amount of time. We don't know if it was 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. We know he was all over the place. So when we can trace Talmidim at later points of his life, that will show substance of what he felt should be given over to the next generation. It's very, very keen and critical, and in terms of understanding and trying to classify him as best as possible. Find that guy.